Hello everybody and welcome to the third Field Notes seminar of this term. Today we have Dr. Christina Rix, and speaking, she's a specialist in ancient Egyptian art and archaeology. Dr. Chris Wingfield will be our discussant for today. He is the Senior Curator of World Archaeology at the Cambridge Museum of Archaeology and Anthropology. We'll follow the normal format where Dr. Rix will give her presentation, Dr. Wingfield will give a reply, and then we open up to the floor. Just to let you know that we are recording the session for our webpage, so please come and talk to us if you have any issues about that. And also for regular visitors of this seminar, the date for the next seminar is wrong on the poster. It will actually be on the 3rd of March. Okay?
Right, thank you. Thanks everybody for coming out. I wanted to explain a bit, to contextualise my talk today. I warned Will that I was recycling a little bit. This is a talk that I originally developed for an AHRC research network on the ethics and aesthetics of archaeology, which is based at Durham University. If any of you know Robin Skeets, the Italian prehistoric specialist who also works on cultural heritage, he's one of the key people in the network, and he had invited me to speak. So we had the first workshop in late November in London, which none of you were at, so this isn't recycling for you. And I'll flag up to you if that's... And that was focused on aesthetics and archaeology, so throwing philosophers of aesthetics into the same room with archaeologists who think about aesthetics, and that was exciting, as you can imagine. The next one I'll flag up is the 2nd and 3rd of April at the Ashmolean Museum in Oxford, and that's going to be looking at ethics, museums, and archaeology. So if you Google sort of AHRC Research Network, aesthetics and archaeology, something like that, you'll find it. And speakers for that one include Ivan Gaskell, Mark Jones, former head of the V&A, and Yanis Galinakis from here in Cambridge, from Cossack. So that, if that, this kind of thing interests you, have a look. This talk today also, it builds on, well, Robin knew when he invited me, he knew my first book, The Beautiful Burial in Roman Egypt, so he said, you really should have been more explicit about what you meant by beautiful burial. I thought I was, but he wanted me to explore that a bit more. And it also relates to a book that's coming out this April called Unwrapping Ancient Egypt. So I'm trying to bridge those two together, and I hope it will be fruitful. It's certainly got some interesting discussion going in the London research network. So I'll make a start. As a recreational runner of the middling variety, middle distance, middle speed, middle fill in the blank, I occasionally find myself in sports shops looking for something to wear that will make me a little less middling, a little more Paula Radcliffe in my running. Increasingly, though, I leave the shop empty-handed because sportswear manufacturers appear to have discovered what women want. Pink. Pink-trimmed shoes, pink tops, fluorescent pink for the winter months from which we are finally emerging, even bright pink weights if you need them. Perhaps I'm meant to see all this pink as a mark of how far women's sports have come, as an intentional, even ironic, insertion of the active female body into public spaces and behaviours previously denied it. But in fact, it just irritates me, for I cannot see my way past the gendered association of the colour and the pinkification of girlhood in consumer society. There's a point to this brief rant, and yes, I am going to talk about mummies. My aesthetic engagement with the colour pink is shaped within a specific cultural framework, which encompasses my personal evaluations of what the colour represents, as well as the look and the feel of all those running products I reject. In other times, in other contexts, pink conveyed something else entirely, and I thought that contrast would be a good place to start thinking about aesthetics in archaeology, and specifically the aesthetics of the Egyptian mummy, and, I'll come to at the end, its ethical implications. I hope the colour's okay on that. It is pink. In Hellenistic and Roman Egypt, a period roughly from around 300 BC to 300 AD, when Egypt was governed first by Greek monarchs and then as part of the Roman Empire, pink was the pigment of choice for a number of burials, especially in the middle part of that era, and especially in the middle part of the country, although the archaeological evidence is scattered. The use of pink in such quantities appears to be an innovation derived from Greek painting techniques, and analyses of other objects like pink mummy masks have identified matter as the main component synthesized with an aluminium hydroxide, if you're better at chemistry than I am, and these are what are known as lake pigments. Many of these burials are known only through objects acquired via the brisk 19th and early 20th century antiquities trade. The painted wooden coffin lid you see here is a good example of the phenomenon, dating to the early 2nd century AD and acquired near Malawi by the Egyptologist Friedrich Wilhelm von Bissing around 1900. Pink dominates the colour scheme of the lid, used not only for the tunic the deceased is represented as wearing, but also for the background of the hieroglyphic inscription that runs along the side, with a millennia-old prayer for offerings for the deceased. Pink is also the colour chosen for the skin of the priestly and therefore male and human figures that you see around the head end on the slide, and for garments worn by several of the deities that are also depicted around the side, including a feather-patterned figure of the revivified god Osiris, who appears as if standing within a shrine on the tall, upright foot end of the lid. The skin of Osiris and the other deities is a golden white, while that of the deceased woman herself, which you can see here in the top view on her hands and her feet, is a bright, almost chalky white, probably a lead-based white. From head to toe, she would be glistening like the teeth in a toothpaste advertisement. Far from being an isolated phenomenon, this combination of pink-tinged garments and gleaming skin recurs elsewhere, as on these coffin lids from the site of Achmim, or you might know it as Panopolis, further to the south. Made either of a moulded mud mixture or of a papyrus paste layered with plaster like papier-mâché, these coffins also derive from the late 19th century antiquities trade. Although the study of associated demotic papyri and demotic inscriptions on the coffins has made it possible to narrow down the date range when they were used, as you see there, and to link the subjects of the coffins to a local, priestly, Egyptian-speaking elite. From the time they entered museum collections until really quite recently, coffins like these and that of Tayuris, the previous one, received little attention either from scholars or from museum visitors, and any attention they did receive tended to be negative. There was something not quite right about them, something that was more than a matter of colour, although that was part of it, I think, or taste. These coffins represented an era of Egyptian history seen as a decline, in no small part due to the late 19th and early 20th century idea that cultural and explicitly or implicitly racial mixing diluted art, society, and the state itself. With their unusual colour scheme, unexpected iconographies, and what was thought to be a corrupting admixture of Greek, Roman, and Egyptian features, these coffins were curiosities, as much as antiquities, in the classificatory schemes of archaeology at the time. They were certainly not works of art like the Fayum mummy portraits discovered around the same time and which may be more familiar. Today, the two coffins on the right of the slide stand together in a large case upstairs at the British Museum, clustered with other coffins from the Hellenistic and Roman periods. In the crowded galleries, visitors glance at them, drawn perhaps by their size, their gilding, their bubblegum glory, but then quickly move on, as if looking for a better sort of mummy. How do we acknowledge, identify, or retrieve the aesthetic experiences of an ancient culture, especially where those might seem so far removed from our own? Perhaps the museum display case is an apt metaphor for this problem, facilitating as it does our unimpeded vision across a gulf of time, place, and being. Yet if we do not at least attempt to recover something of ancient aesthetic concerns, we operate in monochrome, with all the pink and gold and white switched off. Aesthetic remains a bit of a bad word in archaeology. I was recently writing something for a classical archaeologist in the States, a little chapter about Roman sculpture in Egypt, and she questioned my use of the phrase aesthetic preferences. In the chapter, she seemed shocked that I would consider using the word aesthetic and suggested stylistic as an alternative. But judgments about style are our judgments. What I was suggesting was that certain features in the sculpture, some of which we could actually parallel on these coffins, were actors' choices that could be understood as part of a wider aesthetic system rather than simply parsed, as X means Y or A comes from B, as if an arsenal of academic terms, iconography, style, context, could protect us from the pitfalls of our own admiration or revulsion for our objects of study. One reason for its bad reputation is that aesthetics has been conflated with a connoisseurial appraisal, which is seen to privilege judgments of beauty and hence to apply Western standards to non-Western art. In this sense, aesthetic analysis weighed up the relative value of a culture through the relative value of its cultural, that is, its artistic, achievement. For an early generation of archaeologists, Hegel's lectures on aesthetics were influential in this respect and informed the entire layout and richly ornamented design of the Neues Museum in Berlin, which was the work of Friedrich Schiller's student, Friedrich Stuhler. And so you see here the Neues Museum as it opened in 1850, I believe, to the public, and that is the museum that reopened 3 or 4 years ago now, with having been rebuilt by David Chipperfield. If you haven't been, go. In Stuhler's scheme, ancient Egypt and European prehistory occupied the museum's ground floor in galleries that featured, respectively, Egyptian and Doric columns, as well as appropriate wall and ceiling decoration. These cultures represented stages of pre-art in a mythical past, corresponding to the position of ancient Egyptian art in Hegel, who had characterized its distinctive human and animal forms and the pyramids as quote-unquote symbolic, focused too much on an external that hides or fails to express the internal spirit or self. In the early 19th century, when Hegel was writing, Egyptian art was also already bound up with death, which was another reason why, in his scheme, this art could not convey the free and living human spirit of true art. For that, visitors needed to ascend, as they have done, up the staircase to the first floor of the Neues Museum, supported by Ionic columns. Here they could view the art of classical Greece and Rome. Another flight of stairs up to the cast of the Erechtheion porch that you see in the background took visitors to the realm of romantic art, that's romantic with a capital R, which was another Hegelian expression of true art. This topmost floor of the museum featured Corinthian columns and housed the royal collection of old master drawings and prints, which fits the romantic scheme because they expressed the spiritual themes of Christianity. Within a decade or so of the museum's opening, its curators were already beginning to express frustration at fitting their growing collection into Stuhler's grand design. Such was the legacy of archaeology in the 19th century, especially moving into the imperial age, that archaeologists just kept finding more stuff and sending it home. Its hybrid forms, funereal overtones and bright colours, which 19th century audiences would have seen in contrast to the imagined monochrome of classical and medieval sculpture, all helped fix Egyptian art low down the ladder of progress, forever on an entry level. This may epitomise aesthetics as an aesthetic exercise, the outsider always looking in through the distancing glass. But archaeological evidence does offer us ways to switch perspective and see the inside looking at itself. Choices of form, vocabulary, and materials are three such ways in which we can, I think, tease out some of the aesthetics of funerary practice in ancient Egypt. And that's what I'm going to try to do in the next section of my talk. I'll be keeping my focus on the Roman period and on the wrapping and encasing of mummified bodies. These are the beautiful burials of my title, and once I have, I hope, convinced you of the aptness of that phrase, I will then return to the issue with which I've started. What is the gap between ancient experience and modern expectation? And is it possible to overcome it? And that's where the beautiful skulls of the title will come into play. In the Roman period in Egypt, grave goods were minimal, and bodies were often cached in communal tombs overseen by cemetery caretakers, some of whom seem to have combined the role of administrator, gravedigger, and ritual performer. Depending on the locale, burials were made in fresh, purpose-built tombs cut into cliffs or bedrock, like those that you see here, or else they might be inserted into much older tombs, reclaiming and reusing venerated space. Some cemeteries did have tomb superstructures with bodies placed under the floor or set into niches, but these appear to have been more rare, or at least aren't as well preserved. In thinking about funerary practices in Roman Egypt, then, one of the first points to acknowledge is that communal burial was widely practiced and presumably had a positive or at least a neutral value. The arrangement of the bodies may have had its own logic. I know of some cases where family members were grouped together. But it may also have been decided by factors such as space considerations or the time at which bodies were deposited. That seems to have been up to the cemetery caretakers rather than survivors or family members. Gaps of days, weeks, or many months could pass between the time the mummy was prepared and the date it was deposited in the tomb, suggesting that a separation of ritual activities was not unusual. Papyrological documents hint at stages such as the initial washing and laying out of the body, delivery to the embalmers 3 or 4 days after the person had died, and finally a funeral banquet and procession, ideally 70 days, but often much, much later, when all the wrapping and rituals had been carried out. But it's difficult to say anything much more precise than that. What we can say, and here I echo a point that Alice Stevenson has made about pre-dynastic burials in an article about the aesthetics of pre-dynastic burials, is that funerary practices are not about providing for the afterlife in the rather simplistic way that much Egyptological literature and most museum displays would have it. They are also not so much, or not only, about the preservation of an individual identity, but about the commemoration and recreation of a social one, a caveat that applies all the more, counterintuitive as this may seem, when we know that certain individuals were singled out for particular care in terms of the embalming and wrapping of the body and its adornment with masks, shrouds, or coffins, since only a few people received that treatment. Such examples, like the mummy of this woman named Artemidora, are exceptional in both senses of that word. But nevertheless, they can help us understand the sensory, visual, and material world that produced them, and thus the actor's aesthetic intent. Let's begin with the question of outer form. The pink wooden coffin lid that I started with, inscribed for Tayuris, and that's an inset of it up at the top there, adopts a distinctive shape, attested not only for other coffins of the period, but also for mummies, like Artemidora's, which were never placed inside a coffin. All the examples of both coffins and mummies in this form come from Middle Egypt, which is roughly between the Fayum Oasis and Asyut, and date to the 1st and 2nd centuries. To give you some idea of the scale, and that the mummy of Artemidora, the foot end stands nearly a meter high, and the entire mummy is just shy of 2 meters to encase human remains that are preserved to a length of 1.5 meters. So, in other words, there's an awful lot of linen there that's used in the wrapping to bulk the thing up. So all of this linen layered and wrapped so copiously around the body, doing a lengthy, you know, month-long process, wraps an inner core deep within which is the body. So it's a sort of sacred bundle around the embalmed corpse. The head end of the wrapped mummy fits into the hollow of the mummy mask very carefully. They must have been designed to work together. And the mask itself is richly gilded and painted, inlaid with stones, and shows the deceased woman in contemporary dress and an imperial hairstyle which merges with the luxuriant long curls of an Egyptian goddess. There's a hybrid depiction. On the back of the mask, a procession of gods culminates up the center with the resurrection of Osiris, the whole composition arranged with clear reference to temple decoration at the time. Similarly, the curved, flaring top of the foot end, crafted, as far as I know, entirely from the textiles, echoes the shape of certain shrines or stelae and supports further divine imagery. We've got the jackal-headed god Anubis, as well as a Greek inscription in the form of a memorial tablet. The outer forms of this mummy and of the Tyrus coffin thus create their own sacred structure around the body, effective for the wrapped or coffined mummy, even in a tomb that was probably communal. And in fact, we know from Artemidora, from a description that survives, that she was found in a communal tomb, and we don't know the relation that she had to the people there in the tomb. Also, in their outer form, they refer to the long process that has gone into making them, so they embody time, as well as the remains of the deceased. Turning next to the vocabulary for burials at this time, effective, or menchet in ancient Egyptian, is one of the two words commonly used to modify the word burial in funerary prayers and ritual texts of this period. The other is neferet, beautiful, perfect, good. Egyptologists have tended to prefer the translation good when neferet refers to a burial, beautiful when it refers to a body, rather beautiful when it refers to a woman, as in the name of the queen Nefertiti. The difference in translation is one of function versus form, with good emphasizing the function of a burial, conventionally conceived as being about the preservation of the dead, and beautiful emphasizing the aesthetics of form, usually a female form at that. But what is to prevent a burial, male or female, being beautiful? And is its form and visual splendor not also part of a burial's effectiveness as a manifestation of the transfiguration of the deceased into something not of this world, within a set of practices contingent upon the individual's being and relationships in this world? As on the earlier examples I showed, there is certainly something splendid about the effect of the colors and materials used here, most strikingly the gilding, the sculptural effect achieved through molded and hand-finished plaster, and the rich color, including skin that would have been white, I think it's been darkened here by modern varnish, and the rich red of the clothing, again made out of a lead-based lake pigment. Pinks, reds, and purples recur in the funerary art of this time and seem to have symbolic significances as well, which I won't go into. But this does lead into considering not just the visual apprehension of the colors, but also the visual and tactile apprehension of the textiles themselves. For a consideration of materiality and of the signifying role that different materials had in ancient societies, seems to me to offer a helpful way into an aesthetic experience and value system different from our own. Linen textiles make up the majority of this mummy and may have represented the majority of the expense as well. A papyrus letter of the early 2nd century mentions the cost of textiles used for one burial, which was about 10 times the annual wage of a skilled craftsman at the time. More importantly, some of the textiles used in mummification, which had to be linen, and at this period had to be undyed linen, included personal clothing. In earlier periods, we know some of the clothing items were heirloom cloth or pieces donated by family members and members of the household. These textiles wrapped the dead in an individual as well as a social identity. The most finely woven textiles comprised the outermost layer of the mummy and were arguably as beautiful as any gold. The performance of wrapping the mummy was seen by no one but the responsible priests, just like the embalming that preceded it, on which all the ancient Egyptian sources are silent. But the outcome of the wrapping was highly visible, in the sense that it produces this cocoon-like, smooth-sided form, and that's the form that had been used for wrapped mummies since about 2200 BC onwards. To be wrapped, as most sacred images were as well, was to be hidden, safe, preparing for rebirth. Wrapped forms like the mummy, or its doubles in coffins and other objects, exemplify what Jan Assmann has called an aesthetics of secrecy in ancient Egyptian culture, expressed also in the hieroglyphic script, which hardly anybody could read, and in temple architecture. Thus, the very form of the mummy, as well as the process of creating it and the restrictions placed on viewing it, since few people would actually see this or see it for a length of time to really study it, are actually part of its aesthetics. The value of a work of art or other cultural practice need not correlate to its visibility. The aesthetic concerns I have suggested for the mummy of Artemidoro can be echoed in many other mummies from Roman Egypt. The wrapped form, the reference to sacred and thus secret space, the textiles and the elaboration of materials, coloration and decoration. This mummy bears almost the same name, Artemidorus, but derives from a very different site in a social milieu. It's one of the so-called portrait mummies with a painted portrait at the top. Sorry, you're getting a shadow on the top of the screen there. So from the Fayum, from Hawara, it's been famous since it went on display in London in 1889. Today, it shares a gallery at the British Museum with the pink-painted coffins that I showed earlier. But it has been singled out for special treatment that helps stop visitors in their tracks. For Artemidorus, being a mummy rather than a coffin, has been CT scanned, and the results, given their own large display panel, there on the right, next to the supine mummy. With this example, I would like to return to my consideration of how modern interpretations have transmuted the aesthetics of the Egyptian mummy into an aesthetics not of beauty or of the secret, but of dissection, the forensic, and the relentlessly visible. Many museum collections of Egyptian antiquities bear ample evidence that modern ideas about what a mummy is and is for are very different from ancient ones. From the early modern trade in powdered mumia to the penchant for grisly souvenirs, mummies, and fragments of mummies have become part of larger narratives about the individual presumed to have inhabited the body, about the archaeologists, scientists, or collectors associated with the remains, often, of course, in a colonial context, and about ancient Egypt and the Egyptian mummy as tropes of death, disease, danger, the erotic, and the exotic, take your pick. But running through all these narratives is something arguably even more disturbing than the cannibalism of mumia consumption or the dismemberment and commodification of human bodies. It is the search for the beautiful skull. Prior to the paradigm shift of the Enlightenment, with its preference for the penetrating gaze, Europeans were disinclined to unwrap Egyptian mummies, which were rarities in collections until the early 19th century. The founding collection of the British Museum included several small, intact mummies collected by Sir Hans Sloane and Sir William Hamilton. These were revealed to be forgeries only in 1792, when they were unwrapped by Johann Blumenbach, professor of medicine at Göttingen. Composed of ancient linen, neatly arranged around a core of animal or human bones, linen scraps and debris, such mummies had been acquired in good faith in the late 17th and early 18th centuries as examples of mummification, because their external appearance, like little bundles, matched what Europeans had already come to think of as a mummy. The absence of human remains inside the British Museum mummies was a particular disappointment, because Blumenbach's chief aim was to make detailed measurements of skulls. His work laid down the fundamental principles of what would become physical anthropology, including the use of craniometry to develop the new concept of race. Blumenbach's doctoral thesis had characterized human variety through five races, identified by skull shape and skin color, in his terms Caucasoid, Mongolian, Ethiopian, American, and Malayan. The Caucasoid group was so named after the Caucasus Mountains in Georgia, where what he described as the most beautiful skull he had ever studied, that of a woman seen here, had originated. Blumenbach's work was both a product and a promoter of prevailing ideologies, which used race as one way of examining the bewildering differences that confronted Europeans in colonial contact zones. In addition to whatever antiquarian or anatomical insights might be gained from examining mummies more closely, from the late 18th century onwards, there was now another incentive for unwrapping Egyptian mummies, whose preserved skin and bones held the promise of further data for the scientific classification of humankind. During his visit to England, Blumenbach presented his research to the Royal Society, which then met in an elegant set of rooms in Somerset House, now the Courtauld Gallery. The Society of Antiquaries had an adjacent meeting room, while the Royal Academy had study and exhibition space upstairs. Hunter, the surgeon, used to demonstrate anatomy at the academy and had unwrapped a mummy. So all these people moved in the same circles, and in Georgian London, this was the centre of intellectual and cultural life. And Hunter and Blumenbach were only two of the scholars who would bring Egyptian mummies, quite literally, to its table. In April 1825, the Royal Society heard a paper delivered by Dr. Augustus Botsey Granville, a leading proponent of the new field of obstetrics, or male midwifery. Granville had received a mummy and coffin from one of his patients, Archibald Edmund Stone, who had travelled through Egypt in 1819, as a number of British aristocrats and, of course, army officers did. The mummy was untouched, covered, in Granville's words, with bandages most skillfully arranged and applied with a neatness and precision that would baffle even the imitative power of the most adroit surgeon of the present day. We know now that the mummy and coffin date to the late period around 600 BC, thus several centuries earlier than the Roman examples I've been discussing, but with some similarities in terms of the wrapping process and the outer appearance. Over the course of several weeks, Granville undertook the unwrapping and dissection of this mummy at his London home. Medical colleagues and acquaintances, like Edmund Stone, would attend the work in what imagines was a convivial but learned atmosphere and itself an aestheticized performance, though I do wonder what Mrs. Granville thought of the use of her dining room. The actual unwrapping took more than an hour, yielding cloth that weighed 28 pounds. The outermost wrapping was a bandage 11 yards long, which spiraled from the feet to the head and then back down to the chest. On top of the face, which you see here, lay, quote, a thick mass of linen, by no means neatly folded up, covered by a considerable layer of a black bituminous substance. Examining the unwrapped mummy was a tactile, not just visual, experience. Short hair on the shaved head, quote, can be felt by passing the hand over it, and on close inspection may be distinctly seen, wrote Granville. The nose was bent to the right from the force of the bandages, which suggests the direction of the wrapper, a right-handed embalmer working from the head end. And the body, Granville said, was that of an older woman, posed with the hands crossed on the chest. The left hand was clenched and held a resin-soaked wad of textile. The surface of the body was creased with deep wrinkles, which Granville took to indicate that the subject had been overweight. He also observed that the woman had large, pendulous breasts and that the genitals had been shaved as well. Granville proceeded to measure the unwrapped body, quote, with precision, as he put it, and several measurements are duly recorded on the drawings made by a professional artist in expectation of the publication, a guy named Henry Parry, who attended the event. The reason for measuring this really perfect female mummy was to determine her race. For quoting Granville again, it is well known that the Egyptian form has been assumed as the type of a specific variety of the Ethiopian race, particularly by the Venerable Blumenbach. Granville compared the proportions of this mummy to two strikingly different and telling sources. The Venus de Medici, that's a statue, a classical statue, and, quote, the most perfect pelvis of a well-grown Negro girl, which I prepared some years ago, end quote. And possibly this body, the well-grown Negro girl, was the body of someone he treated, and possibly, we are in 1820s London, the body of someone who was or had been a slave. As for the Medici Venus, this Aphrodite of Knidos type had been held up by Winckelmann as the Greek ideal of female beauty, and was also used by the 18th century Dutch anatomist Peter Comper to demonstrate perfect beauty and comparative anatomy. Granville referred to both authors as authorities and concluded that the stature and limb ratios of the mummy corresponded almost exactly to the Venus, yeah, the statue, and that its pelvis was quite different from that of the, quote, Negro girl. The aesthetics of the Egyptian mummy here correspond, through judgment of race, to the aesthetics of classical art in the eyes of an educated and well-travelled gentleman like Granville. Granville was then ready for the next stage of his examination, which he implicitly acknowledged as a destructive act. He writes, having proceeded thus far in my inquiry into the state of preservation of the mummy before me, I determined, perfect and beautiful as it was, to make it the object of further research by subjecting it to the anatomical knife, and thus to sacrifice a most complete specimen of the Egyptian art of embalming. Where the removal of the mummy's wrappings had taken 1 hour, the dissection of the pelvis required 2. In female skeletons, he explained, the pelvis presents the most striking difference in different races, and the pelvis of the mummy comes nearer to the beau ideal of the Caucasian structure. To prove the point to the Royal Society spectators, he had the dissected pelvis of the Negro girl ready for their inspection. The mummy's head next offered confirmation that it was European rather than Ethiopian, and that it specifically resembled the Georgian female type in Blumenbach's, quote, very instructive work on skulls. The drawing that Perry made for Granville demonstrates the Cuvier facial angle, which is this line through the ear to the base of the nose, and then to see what the angle is between the base of the nose and the slope of the forehead. This was a diagnostic tool that the most famous French scientist of the day, Georges Cuvier, had devised for his own studies on the anatomy of race in early 19th century Paris. It was Cuvier who, just a few years earlier, had published the autopsy of Sarcha Bartman, the so-called Hottentot Venus, whose skeleton, preserved genitals, and brain were displayed in the Musée de l'Homme in Paris until the 1970s. An aesthetic evaluation of Egyptian mummies, not for their exterior and what it represents, but for their interior, has had a long tale. Granville's 1820s encounter with an Egyptian mummy of the late period was in many ways of its time, but similar concerns, getting through the wrapping, anatomizing the body, identifying race, have informed the study of Egyptian mummies ever since. Supplanting one aesthetic, such as we see here, this is a wrapped mummy fitted with a gilded mask, there is pink and white there, from the Roman period, with another aesthetic, and the reconstructed face we see at the front here derives from the mummy, is a reconstruction based on CT scanning of that mummy. Also, since I delivered this talk in November, I watched a documentary, I think it was a rerun on the BBC, Cleopatra the Killer or something like that, about the Austrian archaeologists studying the remains that they think are from Turkey, which might be a sister of Cleopatra. And the forensic scientist, Caroline Wilkinson from Dundee, formerly Manchester, who did the reconstruction, compared the skull to Aphrodite. And I did wonder if she realized that she was following the 200-year track of racialist science. So these reconstructions done by McGill University in Montreal a couple of years ago, just one of many examples I could pick. Ever-improving technologies and the forensic turn of the 1970s, which continues apace, mean that today the aesthetics of the Egyptian mummy, presented in museums and the media, are almost entirely to do with the physical remains of corpse, quite the opposite, as we saw, of the ancient actor's intent. Imaginative reconstructions take the study of skulls much further than Blumenbach and Granville, or later Flinders Petrie and Francis Galton, could ever have anticipated. But lest we think questions of race have been forgotten, let me read you part of the somewhat garbled press release that was used to report the McGill facial reconstructions. Egyptian tissue depth data derived from ultrasonic imaging of modern Egyptians were used to flesh out the faces. A diversity of skin tone is shown to reflect the Mediterranean, North African, and Sub-Saharan mixture of the Egyptian population as noted throughout history. Hairstyles were pulled from earlier anthropology reports and detected through the wrappings worn by one of the mummies. Again, I think it's the front reconstruction. So this I found on a website that duly reported on the discovery. The comments and exchanges at the bottom of that and every other website I saw continued to hash out questions of race, but in a much less passive voice. This May, the British Museum will open a summer blockbuster exhibition based on advanced three-dimensional scanning techniques, which it promises will unlock hidden secrets. That's, if you can't read the small type, it's in there somewhere, to reveal to audiences eight ancient lives reconstructed from the evidence of eight ancient bodies. The exhibition updates and expands a similar show from about 8 years ago, also based on three-dimensional scanning, which has spent several years touring overseas, especially in East Asia, and generating significant income for the museum's Egyptian department. Ticket booking, as you can see, is now open. The USP of this kind of scanning, like the scanning used to reconstruct the McGill mummies, is that the bodies within their wrappings and sometimes their coffins or cases, like this example here, are undisturbed. There is no damage, at least not of the physical kind we saw with Granville's dissection. No damage. And yet I cannot help but ask, where we know the wishes of the dead, which is one of the tenets in the Vermilion Accord of 1989, adopted by the World Archaeological Congress, and where we know that mummies were prepared in seclusion for seclusion, what is an ethical position in relation to the curation, study, and display of mummified remains? There has been much spilled ink and bombast over such issues in museums, and I think that will come up at the next, the April HRC workshop. But considering the role of aesthetics, ancient and our own, may offer a different insight, a different way of approaching the question, certainly of understanding our own fascination, why it's so easy for someone on a BBC documentary to refer to a skull as if it were a statue, a Greek statue. Ancient aesthetics made the mummy into a sacred object, a divine and shining image that few eyes could ever, you know, safely see during the process of making it or once it was wrapped. In contrast, forensic aesthetics takes the Egyptian mummy as first and foremost a human body, which can be opened up virtually in much the same way and for the same purpose that it was previously opened up and revealed with scalpels, surgical saws, and the draftsman's pencil. Think you know mummies? The British Museum asks. Well, yes, in this sense, I think we do. Where does beauty lie, and does forensic science reveal or reconfigure it? I began my talk with a little rant about the wrong kind of pink in sportswear. My last slide also showed the wrong kind of pink, the sort of peachy pallor that used to be called flesh and that was used in the McGill reconstructions to try to show different skin tones. But flesh, like the old Crayola crayons, is not a universal value. I end here with the pink of the Tuyurus coffin lid, lying empty in Amsterdam and long separated from its mummified body and its tomb. Having traced today some of the aesthetic principles that I think we can see at work in the Roman Egyptian funerary sphere, and possibly earlier in Egypt as well, I am aware that I have only touched the surface, and aware too that the ancient actors may not have articulated these principles in terms of sense perception, but as a manifestation, for instance, of supernatural effects. To understand the Egyptian mummy on something like its own terms, however, the surface seems a better focus for our attention than the interior, which science and archaeology have emphasized for some 200 years. Here is the beautiful burial, or what is left of it.